as lines, so love's oblique may well themselves in every angle greet. But ours, so truly parallel, though infinite, can never meet. Welcome to another episode of The Troubadour Show. Today I will be reading a poem called The Definition of Love by Andrew Marvell. Now, Andrew Marvell is a 17th century poet. He's born 1621 to 1678. So this is right after William Shakespeare. Shakespeare dies, I think, 1616. So he's right in that era, but it's a different era that we're experiencing in, or that they're experiencing in Europe. And Andrew Marvell is a very interesting poet. One of his great poems is called To His Coy Mistress, where he tries to essentially seduce a mistress by making the argument that, hey, if we had all the time in the world, we could, you know, have this cautiousness and coyness and wait forever and, you know, don't worry about time, and we could take thousands of years and I could love every inch of you for, you know, 200 years for this body part and 1,000 years for that body part. And, but we don't have time. We're limited here on this earth for a very short amount of time. So let's make love and enjoy life while we're here. Except he does it, of course, in a poetic way. And it's a very fun and, I think, enjoyable poem. Now, this poem is very different. So this poem is called The Definition of Love. And I want to ask you, and we're going to go through this afterwards, after we read this, to think about if you agree, or where can you learn from Andrew Marvell? How can you apply this thought to your life? Now, I will say up front that this is not, the, in my view, the purpose of poetry, to teach you something, although it can teach you something. But one thing that I think a good poem like this can do is it can give you something to contemplate, as well as enjoying the metaphors, the sounds, the meaning, all of it intertwined in one thing. So what I'm going to do, as I always do, is I'm going to read the poem to you. And now I just want to say that if you are, you know, lost in any time, that's okay. Don't worry about, you know, getting everything correct and understanding every word. There's a lot that I don't understand sometimes. I'm looking stuff up. So there's a lot I'm trying to figure out myself. And, you know, I'm doing my best to go through this, but there are some basic techniques that you can use. And we'll talk about that a little bit. But first, let me just read the poem. So I'll read the poem. You could just listen, tune out, and read on your own, skip forward, whatever you want to do. But I recommend, you know, I'm not going to read it twice. I recommend you read it a couple of times yourself to really get some understanding and enjoyment out of the poem. Okay, so here is the poem, The Definition of Love by Andrew Marvell. My love is of a birth as rare as 'tis for objects strange and high. It was begotten by despair upon impossibility. Magnanimous despair alone could show me so divine a thing, where feeble hope could ne'er have flown, but vainly flapped its tinsel wing. And yet I quickly might arrive where my extended soul is fixed, but fate does iron wedges drive and always crowds itself betwixt. For fate with jealous eye does see two perfect loves, nor lets them close. Their union would her ruin be, and her tyrannic power should depose. And therefore, her decrees of steel us as the distant poles have placed, though love's whole world on us doth wheel, not by themselves to be embraced. Unless the giddy heaven fall, and earth some new convulsion tear, and us to join, the world should all be cramped into a planisphere. As lines, so love's oblique may well themselves in every angle greet, but ours so truly parallel, though infinite, can never meet. Therefore, the love which us doth bind, but faith so enviously debars, is the conjunction of the mind and opposition of the stars. Okay, so hopefully that sounded okay to you. I think I made actually a couple pronunciation errors, but my recommendation is always to just read through these, enjoy them, get the most out of them. There's definite changes in pronunciation that happens. You can't beat yourself up about this. The point of reading poetry is to enjoy as much as you can. But we'll go through them and, you know, I think I'll try and point out what I think I pronounced wrong. And if you think I pronounced something wrong, just put it in the, you know, in the chat. You know, I don't have any kind of specialty in 17th century pronunciation. So for here, just as an example, as tis, you know, so for this first stanza, my love is of a birth as rare as tis for objects strange and high. It was begotten by despair upon, now I want to say impossibility, because it goes with the high. Alone, flown, thing, wing, and he often does. So I don't know if that's mispronunciation or if he just couldn't think of another word, so he used that. That happens too. You know, I don't know if impossibility was once pronounced a little bit differently in Britain in the 17th century. But let's go through this poem. Let's kind of think about what we might be seeing here. So the first stanza, and again, the poem is called The Definition of Love. So you're always trying to think about that as you're going through it, assuming that's how he actually titled this. A lot of times poets don't title it, so I'm actually not clear on that. But let's assume The Definition of Love is the title. My love is of a birth as rare as 'tis for object strange and high. It was begotten by despair and upon impossibility. Okay, so right off the bat, he's talking about birth, love. So these are some, you know, particular words that I'm noticing is relevant to this stanza. And he's saying, my love is, oh, and I touched my pen, but no, I was totally unconscious. This is my love token, by the way. My love is of a birth as rare as 'tis for objects strange and high. So it's a rare thing. He's referencing something strange and high, maybe the heavenly, but begotten. So begotten is, in this case, I think about birth. So he's talking about the begotten. What is the begetter, the birther, the parents of his love? Despair and impossibility. So you have these two, you know, abstractions or feelings in this case, despair and impossibility. So in a sense, his love's, you know, origins are in something that's impossible to him and his despair. Okay, so right off the bat, we're getting a pretty despondent poem that we're, you know, I probably shouldn't laugh. Poor guy. I mean, we've all been there. I'm definitely there. For sure, where you have this dejection, this despair, and maybe you think that your love, and let's assume for the sake of this whole poem, because I think it becomes clear that the love is for a person, a woman in this case, and it's a high, heightened, elevated love. It's a wonderful love, but it's for him begotten by despair and impossibility. Okay, so I don't want to go too, I don't want to take forever on just that. But there's a lot to think about. Think about the idea of love being born of despair and impossibility. So what is he talking about here? So magnanimous, this is stanza two, magnanimous despair alone could show me so divine a thing, where feeble hope could ne'er have flown, but vainly flapped its tinsel wing. So we have something here where we're getting this magnanimous despair. So that's like a kingly, generous, giving despair. It's the king is what I think of when I think of magnanimous. And to him, the magnanimous despair has the divinity in it, where hope is feeble. So in a sense, he's saying, I think, that were he to have hope in his love, it would actually debase the love, or it would at least make it tinsel wings, so glittery little wings, feeble, you know, flapped, fragile, so and vain. So we get words like that when it comes to hope versus despair is magnanimous, divine. Okay, so here's, this is an interesting idea now that we're getting clear in our minds about what he's talking about in just two stanzas, is that you have his despair and impossibility, but that's a divine thing. That's kingly. Whereas if he were to actually have hope that this would, this love could happen, it's a tinsel wing. It's flapped. It's feeble. It's vain. Okay. So that's a little, it's a little odd, I think. But, you know, what's he trying to say? Is there anything to what he's saying? And do we ever think that? I think sometimes we may have emotions that are similar in our beliefs to this. Okay, stanza three. And yet I quickly might arrive where my extended soul is fixed, but fate does iron wedges drive and always crowds itself betwixt. So he says something like, yet I quickly might arrive where my extended soul is fixed, So it's like, but fate does iron wedges drive and always crowds itself betwixt. I mean, what I'm getting from this, I quickly might arrive where my extends. If I could get to this place, you know, could I reach my beloved in a sense? That's where my spot is extended to. Like it's like, that's where he's at. If fate would not get in the way. So, and in this case, get in the way is iron wedges driving. So there's something about fate being the thing that's getting in between him and his love. Okay. So we have these three stanzas. Now we have a stanza, you know, that, so we're starting to get some understanding, I think, of what's happening. We have a stanza of his, you know, the origins of his birth, of his love, which is despair and impossibility. Of him calling despaired love, impossible love, magnanimous, versus hope, which is tinsel, fleeting or glittery. Yet he could arrive at this anchor point of between heaven and earth, maybe, but fate stands in his way and crowds itself between him, betwixt, between him and his love. Okay, so why is love doing this? I think that's what we're getting in the next stanza. For fate with jealous eye does see two perfect loves, nor lets them close. Their union would her ruin be, and her tyrannic power depose. Okay, so fate is jealous. So fate as in, you know, think about Romeo and Juliet, two star-crossed lovers who are fated to be together. So they're fated to be together. The gods are the ones who are bringing everything together, and this is the 17th century. So they would, but in his case, they don't bring them together. He's not able to have the union. So the two perfect loves, his love and her love, are not going to close, like a circle closing into a united whole. And this is why? Because of her tyrannic power deposed, or what she's deposing of her power. So, you know, she has a kind of cruel throne that she's, this is fate, not allowing to be moved into of their love. Okay, so here we have the next stanza. And therefore her decrees of steel us as the distant poles, P-O-L-E-S, have placed. The love's whole world on us doth wheel, not by themselves to be embraced. Okay, this one's an important one, I think. And therefore her decrees, that's fate, of steel, her steel decrees, her unflinching decrees for us, is the distant poles have placed. So I'm getting this sense of something about the distant poles. Now, I don't think he means like a pole that you put in the ground. I think because he's talking about the world, and then we get hints later on in the poem too that helps us understand this. But we get, the poles are like the poles that go through, you know, the earth, right? So it's the poles of the earth, the North Pole, the South Pole, which are two opposite poles. They've been placed there. But if you think about it, those two poles can never touch, right? So if you think about, if you were to personify North Pole, personify South Pole, they're never going to interact with each other. So if they were in love and wanted to spend the night together, be together, marry each other, they can't do that, right? Because they're obviously there, separated from each other. And he puts this in parentheses, but the whole world is on us does wheel. So the whole world revolves around their love. So it's very important, but at the same time, it's a love that cannot, you know, it's again, a love born of despair and impossibility. So they can't be together. So again, I think this is an interesting metaphor, even though it's pretty dark and bleak and sad in a lot of ways. Okay, but wait, maybe there's some hope here. What's he saying here? Unless, so this is the next stanza. Unless the giddy heaven fall, and earth some new convulsion tear, and us to join the world should all be cramped into a planisphere. Okay, so I think what he's saying here is that if the giddy heaven fall and earth some new convulsion tear. So like, again, you have these two poles. Imagine that. South and love, North are in love with each other, but they can't be together. What's the one way they could be together? They were a planisphere, they were flat. Right. And so then what would that do to the world? That would crush the whole world, right? And everyone would die and everything would be bad, but at least the North and South Pole would be together. So unless the giddy heaven fall, so the heavens fall and earth, some new convulsion tear and us to that, to join the world should all be cramped into a planisphere. So that's the only way he thinks that their love can happen. And of course that's a bad thing. And it's the sense of destroying the world. As lines, so loves oblique may well themselves in every angle greet. But ours, so truly parallel, though infinite, can never meet. So lines, so oblique may... So the lines one, I don't know if he's talking about poetry here. I always think when I hear lines from a poet that there's something about that, but there may be something about these lines. So when you think about like the lines of a poem, I often think of that. But lines has other meanings too. So, because he also talks about truly parallel. So maybe he's talking about the parallel lines that are keeping them apart of the two North Pole, South Pole. So loves oblique may well themselves in every angle greet, but ours so truly parallel, though infinite, can never meet. I mean, to me, this is, he's still telling us some ways that they can never be together. So loves oblique. So that's what, like not parallel, basically not exactly able to be parallel. So in every angle greet, but ours so truly parallel, though infinite, can never meet. Therefore, so we get this lament that they cannot be together. Therefore, the love which us doth bind does bind. Therefore, the love which us does bind. So the love that binds us, but fate so enviously debars, makes impossible, bars us from each other, is the conjunction of the mind in opposition of the stars. So the love that binds us, that fate enviously keeps us apart, is the conjunction of the mind and the opposition of the stars. So the very stars, the very heavens, the very earth, that's what's keeping us apart in a sense. Now, I want to say like what it's, what he's trying to say, I think overall, and you may disagree with this interpretation and that's fine. It sounds to me and it feels to me that he is in a despondent state of experience as he's writing this about a love he cannot have. And so he's justifying in a largesse manner and a wide brooch of, hey, I'm in this despair, so I'm going to show you this, how this impossibility is actually better than the real thing. And so he builds this whole conceit, this whole narrative, this whole world where the impossibility of the love is what makes it great and wonderful love. So do you agree with that? Do you agree that the fact, like there's something, you know, I could take a step back of abstraction and say that there's something more beautiful in the impossibility. This is what I might call platonic love, or a love that's not able to be fully actualized and realized in nature, in the actual world. That's, I think, a little bit of what he's saying. And there is that, we do, I think, often have a view like that in our culture. We sometimes think that the love that is, you know, to have elevated romantic love of the highest order, and we have all these stories of lovers who love from afar but can never have, you, if you have read or watched Les Miserables, or there's obviously Don Quixote, this is in our culture quite a bit. It's, now, it's not as much, I think, in our everyday American culture today, but there's still, I think, a sense where practical, real, everyday love is not this grand, romantic, a big love in a sense. It's really just, you know, like that kind of love is just for fairy tales and storybooks, but the love of a man and wife trying to get together and have kids and raise family and do all the practical necessities of life, that kind of romantic love is not possible today. So I do think that dichotomy between the high love and romantic love and the practical everyday necessities is very prevalent. And I think this is making an argument in poetic form, in poetic verse, for the former, for the love as separated, that's the heightened version. And this is another way to put this is the mind-body dichotomy. Now, I'll just tell you my personal belief. My personal belief is that this is not the case, that we don't have that dichotomy, that you can have both an elevated, real sense of love, even when it seems impossible. And that I do not believe that chivalry is dead, although it's mostly not in the culture. And I want to give you a little bit of an understanding of what I mean by chivalry. So chivalry is something that goes back to literature of the 12th century, which is primarily in the, I believe it begins heavily in the court of the Queen of Aquitaine, which is basically France. She had a large territory that she was in charge of for a long time, including Britain. And there was some literature and things were happening. And I'll just say briefly, one of the interesting occurrences of this era was that because of the geography in the south of France, there were not much south of the territory of France at that time, not France of today, of the 12th century. You can look at a map of what that looked like. But the territory was separated and from the warring north. So the south did not have a lot of wars going on. They were not fighting a lot in the south of France. But in the north of France, where they were dealing with rebellion in England and things like that and all kinds of wars going up there, there was a lot of warring going on. So the poetry of the time, one of the most famous ones of this era, is the Song of Roland, which is a big war epic that does have some elements of love, but love is not a big component of it. Now, in the south of France, these are just representative poems, epic poems, or longer poems. In the south of France, there's something called Yvain, or The Night of the Lion, by Chrétien de Troyes. And this one is a love poem, and you get a kind of courting system in it. You get a method of how you're supposed to court somebody. And the idea of courting comes from kind of this medieval era where there was a formalistic way of courting after a woman. But even more than that, part of what's happening in the real world at this era is you have all of these knights and troubadours. Yes, this is the era of the troubadours. You have all these knights and troubadours who are, a lot of them come from some kind of families, you know, and they're just kind of hanging around a court, maybe a castle. They don't have as much to do in the south of France, again, because they're not fighting. And so they start just kind of telling stories to each other. They start singing songs to each other. Some of them are very sexual. Some of them are very bawdy. But some of them start, you know, having a little bit of like what love is. And, oh, I cannot have this princess over here. I cannot have this woman, but I'm in love with her. And so this is a lot of the sense that we get of this idea of love for this person that's separated from the physical, you know, interaction with them. Now, in that, I think there's a whole literature that develops, and there's a whole strain, I think, of romance literature that goes all the way to today, where there is a kind of heightened sense of what love is and what love can be. Now, personally, I consider myself a high romantic, but in Ayn Rand's terms and views, I consider myself a romantic realist, not only in my fiction, but also in my life. I think it is actually something that's real. So my understanding of romantic realism, and this is not Ayn Rand, this is just me, but what I believe in is that you can have both. You can have a high elevated sense of the world, of romance, of love, of your work, and of striving for the object of your desire, and you can have it for reals. And I think that in a lot of cases, people don't actually believe that that's possible. I think whether we realize it or not, we think we have to compromise and get somewhere in between, or, you know, move more toward just being practical. When I see a lot of advice that's out there about how to deal with a breakup, how to deal with relationships, how men should talk to women, a lot of it is very practical, psychological, do this, don't do that, have this kind of view. Like the idea of having some kind of long-term commitment, even if you're not together with somebody in a moment, would be considered ridiculous in most cases. But the knights of old did that kind of thing. They would wear tokens of love as they go into battle, or as they, you know, do jousting, even if they couldn't be with that woman. So a romantic realist, though, so that's like a romance in novels that are separated from the actual getting together. Although there are famous poems, Guinevere and Lancelot, for instance, and there's all kinds of, you know, wonderful poems where they do get together. And then there's all the things that get in the way of them being together. And there's also, I think, truth to that. But in my view, it's very practical if you find the love that you want and you hold in your mind the vision of the world and the life that you want to have long term, and you keep it in the realm of the hopeful. So This is where I completely disagree with Andrew Marvell. The second that these things become hopeless, really and truly hopeless, impossible, that's when the advice should be to leave it alone and drop it. But so long as there's even some sliver of hope, if you really have that heightened view of love, if you really understand what it means to love somebody and to have that on the highest level possible to human beings, we're not animals. We could choose to be better. If you can have that heightened sense of love, it is, in my view, very much worth it. But it has to be grounded in reality. This is where poets and philosophers and artists and, you know, literary writers get lost, is that they hold on to that, you know, mega balloon of romanticism and romance and love, and it drifts them off and they forget to plant their feet into the ground of reality. And that's where both have to, and that's where romantic realism goes into play. They're both together. So you have to be focused on the facts of reality. You have to, and that in the case of, you know, romance, that means it can't be a love that's completely impossible. So like falling in love with an Angelina Jolie, like what that's that you're watching her TV, like that kind of impossibility, that's not heightened real love. Falling in love with someone who doesn't want to be with you and despises you or doesn't like you, that's enough. But if there's, you know, a good amount of or some kind of evidence that one day this is possible, I do think that it's worthwhile to have the heightened sense of love and romance, even if it's just for yourself, for your own ability to move and generate values in the world. Okay, so that was my rant about chivalry courting. I don't think chivalry needs to be dead. I think we can, I'll speak to men. I think we can bring it back by being imaginative, being good people, and being grounded in reality and focused on, you know, building ourselves up and not reading into things that aren't real and really trying to think about what's the best way to live a romantic, imaginative, flourishing life. So that's the Troubadour Show, and I'll see you next time.